And I realize I missed a lot, because the talks have been fantastic. And just also, I thank the organizers for having a nice schedule where there's lots of time to talk to the other participants. I think this is a really wonderful conference, and it's really well done. So thank you, guys. In fact, let me just, since you just thanked the secretaries, I think we should give a round of applause for the actual organizers of this talk right now. So I think I'm supposed to talk about topological quantum algorithms for learning topological features of data. But I thought I would actually, since this is the last talk of the conference, I thought I would actually just do a little kind of summary, despite the fact I wasn't here for the first couple of days, of kind of, you know, let's look at the quantum machine learning in perspective. I think this was a really, one of the things I really liked about this conference is that it covered all possible aspects of machine learning. So here is the machine, right? And here is the data. And you know, ordinary classical machine learning has classical, the machine is classical and the data is classical, right? We heard a bunch of really, I found them really fascinating talks about the use of classical machine learning techniques to look at quantum mechanical systems. This is a wonderful idea. I mean, you know, people have been burning massive amounts of supercomputer time for decades to try to understand how quantum systems behave, because they behave in a weird fashion. And you know, it's not easy to figure out what's going on with them. And quantum systems are famous for generating strange and counterintuitive patterns. So the whole notion that you can actually have a classical machine that's capable of learning what these strange and counterintuitive patterns are, this is great. So, good. we've heard a bit about having quantum machines learning about classical data. I'm going to say a fair amount about it in just a second. But there's been, if you like, this is really what the first use of quantum machine learning was, to take look at devices like how you take the D-Wave machine, for instance, a quantum annealer, and have it look at classical data. If you look at the literature of this, when Patrick Rebentost and I started working on quantum machine learning a few years ago, actually Patrick came into my office and he said, "Hey, Seth, we should do quantum machine learning." And I said, "Great, what's machine learning, right?" Because I kind of knew vaguely, but I didn't know what was going on. And Patrick started to explain to me how machine learning algorithms worked. And I said, "Oh yeah, I think we could quantize some of these things." And so we started doing that. But then, of course, for writing the papers, we actually had to do a thorough literature search. By the way, I have to confess that when I start working on a problem, I don't read the literature to begin with, because I just try to work out what I can do on my own, and I only read the literature if I get really stuck, okay? Because otherwise, if you read all the literature to begin with, then you've kind of like, you've forgotten why you were actually trying to do this in the first place, and so that's bad. But of course, it's extremely important, and not only that, it's your obligation as a scientist to do a very thorough literature search before you write the paper, and to figure out what's out there, and to find out if you've been scooped, and you know, and then to be honest about that. So we did a very thorough literature search when we started writing up our papers, and we found some very interesting things about machine learning. People have been looking at quantum machine learning, quantum devices, for a while. And there are a lot of nice papers from people from like the folks like Hartmut Nevin at Google and the people at D-Wave dating back to around 2010, maybe even earlier. When did you write your first papers on this? Around 2010, to say, oh, let's look at what happens when you apply a quantum annealer to classical data. And let me just say a little bit about this. This is a really great idea because, I mean, the basic idea is the following. It's like the basic intuition about say applying a device like the D-Wave device to data is, look, quantum systems famously generate patterns that are strange and they're very hard to generate classically. Now, you know, this is not a secret, okay? And now in deep learning, where you have these deep networks, then deep learning networks like Boltzmann machines typically can both, they're there to recognize patterns, but then they can generate patterns as well. And so, you know, they generate the same types of patterns that they recognize. And so you certainly expect something like a deep quantum network to be able to generate patterns that are hard to produce classically. This is related to this unfortunately named term quantum supremacy, which I think I mentioned the yesterday to someone of the this has very bad connotations for me, quantum supremacy. And whenever I mention to someone in humanities, they go, "Oh my God, that's so horrible, how politically incorrect." However, it has the advantage that if Trump is elected president, then we can ask for more money to restore America's quantum supremacy. You know, the Canadians are doing too good a job on this, you know. We're going to have to build a quantum wall. So it makes perfect sense to apply these devices. You know, we know that they're generating patterns that are hard to generate classically, though of course proving that that's true is hard. So maybe they can recognize patterns that can't be recognized classically. And here, although I think the jury is still out whether this is true, I would say that the kinds of work that's been going on from D-Wave and other people who have looked at this, like the people at Google, there's pretty good evidence that something interesting is happening, something different is happening in these deep quantum networks, and maybe it's better than what's happening classically. So I think this is quite an exciting field. And then the last thing, of course, is quantum devices, quantum data. I mean, this is a completely natural, but in fact, ironically, I think this has not been really investigated as much as it should have been in the past. And we've heard lots of talks at this conference where people mention this. So, I mean, you know, you have a quantum mechanical system. Now, let's use another quantum mechanical system to understand what's going on. Now, it's been known for decades since Feynman's work in 1982, when he first suggested this, that you can actually use a quantum device to simulate a quantum system. And back in 1995, I showed that you could, you know, use a gate model quantum computer to simulate other quantum systems. But of course, if you have a quantum device that can simulate another system, then you're in great shape for actually, you know, doing quantum learning to try to learn what's actually happening, because that's really how these machine learning techniques work. You know, you have a bunch of, you have an artificial system that's trying to recognize and produce patterns that are found in nature. And you're tweaking the parameters of your system, your artificial system, to try to match them up to the patterns that are actually out there. So let's actually look at the, you know, the time-space trade-offs. I don't want to go too long into this, but I did think that this is good to have a general picture before I start talking about algebraic topology, because my experience is that when I start talking about algebraic topology, then many people just fall asleep, so I thought I'd try to keep people awake for a little bit. An interesting thing about classical machine learning, I found, like, so when Patrick and I started making these algorithms that we could show that they were exponentially faster than the best known classical algorithms, we went to go try to compare them with people who are doing, you know, real machine learning, and there are gajillions of people out there doing machine learning. And we said, well, we're doing, here's our guarantee, you know, we can say do principal component analysis for, you know, a data set with n pieces of data, and we can do this in time, you know, log n squared. What's the best that you can do? And they go, oh, I don't know, we do this and do that, it works really well, right? It's very frustrating, and actually in deep learning, this is particularly the case, that, you know, deep learning is famously works quite well, but there's no guarantees that it's supposed to work well. In fact, it's kind of weird that it works this well. When I was a postdoc at Caltech, I was working with Murray Gell-Mann from 88 to 91, showing how antique I am, I would go and talk with John Hopfield. This was back in the days when, you know, Hopfield networks and neural networks had just been coming in, and they had some initial advances and successes, but they weren't working that well. You know, they could learn a few patterns, and that was it. And I remember Hopfield saying, you know, I understand, he said, that these aren't working well right now, but if we had computers that were a million times more powerful, and if we had a billion times more data, these would work, I swear, right? And actually, what's going on right now is exactly that. I mean, the basic techniques of classical machine learning, things like, you know, neural network techniques or support vector machines or various deep learning kinds of things, and things like contrastive divergence, stuff we've been hearing about, that Boltzmann machines. These are all stuff from the 70s and 80s. And the reason that they're working now is that we have, you know, we have like little smartphones that are the have the power of supercomputers of 1988, right? And we have not but just billions of times more data, but trillions of times more data. MIT is, there's an annoying thing about being a professor at MIT, which is that one's colleagues are so enthusiastic about technology that they make MIT adopt it at a very early stage. So for instance, if you've been to MIT and you come in through the main door is an automatic door. It's the oldest continuously functioning automatic door in the world. Because MIT was like, yeah, we gotta have automatic doors, it's 1910, man. And of course, this means it's broken all the time, right? And so in 1998 or something like that, I remember very well, this was a very annoying thing happened. Some bright-eyed professor of computer science convinced MIT to fire their telephone operators and to replace them with a computer program with voice recognition software. And for the next 5 years, whenever you called up MIT, the following thing would happen. You'd say, I'd like to speak with Jane Smith. And the computerized voice would say, now ringing Mary Lefkowitz. And if this is not the right number, press 9. Boop. Jane Smith. Now ringing Hua Zhang. Boop, 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 boop. This lasted, you know, it was went on what first seemed like an eternity. But now, actually, if you take your smartphone, it actually does really an amazingly good job about learning patterns and learning and being able to recognize your voice. It's not only is it this because it's much more powerful and the data sets are much larger, but they have adaptive algorithms that adapt to your own voice. So you, like, you're dictating and it asks you, is this what you said? And you say, no, I meant to say this. Then it figures that out. And it works well. It's amazing. Much better than the old days. So stuff of progress is being made. So you know what, let me not talk about these time-space trade-offs. I will just mention about this quantum classical thing, is that, this was mentioned in the last talk by Damien, that the real kick-ass applications of applying a quantum computer to classical data are enabled if you have a quantum random access memory. If you have a quantum random access memory, the point is that I can take a vector, which belongs, let's say, to C to the capital N, and I can map it to a quantum state, which is a vector, and this also belongs to C to the N. But this vector in the classical computer has order N bits that needs to describe it, and the quantum one has order log N bits that you need to describe it, qubits, log n qubits. So if you can map a classical data into a quantum vector, you have an exponential compression of the representation of the data. Of course, this is in some sense a much worse representation of the data because we know very well that if you want to recreate all this, you have to have order n copies of this and be able to make order n measurements on it. But the whole point of these quantum machine learning algorithms is that if you can do things like quantum Fourier transforms, if you can do things like find eigenvectors and eigenvalues, if you can do things like invert matrices, then the classical versions of these are all things that goes like order, this is order n log n, this is order n squared for sparse matrices, this is order n log n for sparse matrices, and the quantum versions of these are all things that are exponentially faster, log n squared, this is order log n squared again, over epsilon, where that's the accuracy you want to find the eigenvectors, and this is order again. This is order something like log n cubed. So the quantum versions of this are exponentially faster. So what we really actually, what would be really great would be to construct a quantum random access memory. And as Damien said, we don't have a realistic design for this at the moment. We have on paper designs. I even have a patent on this. Including the classical version of it, by the way, and and we have proof of principle experiments. Fabio Sciarrino did this a few years ago, but it would be really great to build something like this. And this is it takes order n switches. So in order to build, and these have to be quantum switches. But the great news is this about this, if you can build this. So this is, you know, you got to build a big quantum device. On the other hand, you know, D-Wave has already built big quantum devices, and it's clear that you can make large-scale quantum integrated circuits. And so, sorry, you were asking a question? Okay. and the nice thing about this is that the error rate that you can tolerate for these switches goes as 1 over log n. So, you know, if you have a database with 2^100 items in it, you can tolerate a 1% error rate, which is great. So you don't have to like have quantum switches like the things you need for quantum computers, quantum gates that have 4 nines of accuracy. 2 nines of accuracy would be more than ample for such switches. You need to, and the energy consumption, as this is, I want to emphasize this, because Damien mentioned that these switches, when they're off, they're in the ground state, so they're actually not dissipating. So the energy consumption also goes as order log n. And so this is, by the way, also true for the classical device, which is, I mean, you could build classical versions of these where you might have much less energy consumption than an ordinary RAM. I told this to the people at Texas Instruments. They came by, and they're very interested. And they took our design off to TI, and they came back a couple of weeks later and said, "Now we're not interested any longer." And I said, "Why?" And they said, "Well, we admit that the energy consumption will be, you know, exponentially less, but you know, it's already so hard to build these RAMs the way we build them, that to build them the way you want to build them would be kind of like Detroit going from gasoline-powered cars to electric cars, and it's going to be hard." That's what they said. This was like about 7 or 8 years ago, so I think maybe it is possible. Anyway, so I want to emphasize that this is a great thing, and I think that people in this audience who are experimentally inclined, be a great thing to go talk with your experimental colleagues and go and take a look at how one could build such a device. I think that because of these particular features right here, despite the fact that you have to build a large-scale quantum circuit to do this, this is an effort which is certainly no more, not harder than building a large-scale quantum computer with full-blown error correction, and might actually be easier. If we could do it, it would be awesome. Maria, you had a question.
Just quickly, so in your comparison, in the spirit of the talk before, so for example, for like the linear system of equations, sometimes you need the Mach metrics to be sparse. So are you clear in comparing classical methods?
Yeah, this is for sparse matrices, and conjugate gradient descent is the best classical method for a sparse matrix, at least the best that I know of. I mean, I don't think you're going to get better than n log n classically. Though it's hard to prove that, by the way, but it seems really implausible. Okay, are there any more questions or comments about this while I erase it, while I erase things, and actually talk about what I'm supposed to talk about? Anybody want to say something? Come on, like, or want to tell a joke or something like that? Okay.
Could you comment on your assumption about the sensitivity to errors, or what kind of error model you're assuming there?
Yeah, this is a very general error model. This is an error model where, so, like, for instance, somebody comes in with a hammer and knocks out order, you know, a fraction of your switches that goes, you know, 1 over log n of your switches. The thing still gives the right states. It does this mapping of, mapping V goes to V. It does this mapping with a, if you knock out a fraction epsilon of your switches, just kill them, destroy them, then you get a fidelity 1 minus epsilon for this mapping.
I can believe that. I guess the thing that I always think of when I look at the QRAM design, it looks like a massive interferometer, in which case it looks like you would have an incredibly difficult interference issue if there is a coherent error in the system.
Yeah, but that's a good point. It's not an interferometer. It's a branching tree without interference. So it's actually, this is...
That's if the quantum switches work perfectly.
No, it's not. The quantum switches are supposed to create a quantum superposition of access to the different memory parts. So the point is that if you look at the error rate, then it's, you know, again, if you take an error rate epsilon gives you fidelity 1 minus epsilon for the overall, sorry, 1 minus log n times epsilon times for the overall efficiency. Okay. Let me actually talk about the topological algorithms, because this is an algorithm First of all, it's kind of cute, if I do say so myself. I was happy that we figured this out. This is work with Paolo Zanardi and Silvano Garnerone. And I'm also collaborating with an Italian mathematician, Francesco Vaccarino, about some of the work I'm going to tell you about now. I'm proud of this work because it's one of these things, like, you ever read a novel, and you read a famous novel, and everybody says, you should read War and Peace. And you start reading it, and you go, you get in like 50 pages, you say, I just can't hack it, and you stop, right? And then you say, well, and a few months later, you say, I really should read War and Peace. And then you go and you like get into just like 70 pages, and then you stop, and you can't hack it, right? And so, but then, you know, sometimes, like the fourth time around, you get into it, and then you figure it out, then you just read the whole thing. This happens to me frequently. And this also happens scientifically. So about 7 or 8 years ago, Mario Grossetti at the Institute for Scientific Interchange said, Seth, you should really read this stuff about persistent homology and topological analysis of data. I said, oh yeah, that's great, send me the paper. So I started reading the papers and I got like, you know, one page and I said, I don't understand this at all, right? And then I did it again, I didn't understand it at all. But then a few years ago, Paolo and I sat down, Paolo knows a lot more about topology than me, we sat down, and in Banasque, and every morning for 2 hours, we'd look at the papers and we'd talk about them, and finally we were able to figure out what was going on. And so I'll explain this to you now, what was going on in these papers. How many people here have a background in, how many people here have studied algebraic topology? Right, a few, that's great. How many people here have not studied algebraic topology? Right, most of people, and some people didn't raise their hands either way, but that's okay. Okay. So here's the kind of problem that these topological methods are supposed to address. So here's a data set, okay? This data set has a hole. You know, this data has got a hole in it, right? It's a topological feature, a hole. It's obvious that it has a hole. But how do you figure this out? How, if you give this to a computer, you know, how does it figure out that there's a hole? Right? I mean, if I look up close, it's all holes. There's just one big hole. But, you know, as I move further away, and if I'm going to be careful here, because if I take off my glasses and I don't have very good sight, it's like, oh, yeah, yeah, it's like this smeared out thing, and there's a hole in this smeared out thing. And then if I move away further, in my case, it's like, oh, it's just like some smushed out ball, right? But over a fairly long range of smearing out, there is a hole. And so the way that this works, and this is a method called persistent homology, you start by grouping together the data on scales of epsilon, so you're gonna connect things if things are within epsilon of each other. Here, nothing is connected when it's within epsilon of each other, so it's all holes. But once I start actually making these bigger, then I'm gonna start connecting things like this, and then at a particular grouping scale, for instance, at this grouping scale, you'll see that I'm going to get a smeared out version of this data, which has a hole in it. Then finally, if my grouping scale contains the whole thing, then there's no hole. Okay? So the idea about persistent homology is that you look for features of the topological features of the data, like holes, that persist over many grouping scales. And if you have a feature that persists over many grouping scales, then you say this is a real topological feature of the data, okay? And if it, you know, just comes into existence and goes away, you say, well, maybe it's just a blip or something like that. By the way, there's a very good reason to, is this reasonably clear? You gotta like nod your heads, or yeah, people are nodding their heads. Okay, good, great. there's a very good reason for doing this, by the way. And this was told to me by Michael Friedman, who actually was one of the originators of the actual classical versions of this. In fact, I gave a talk about this at Microsoft a year and a half ago, and Michael Friedman got all excited because he basically developed these techniques back in the 70s or 80s for some secret DARPA program, and he got really excited and he ran off to his office and got me copies of the top secret papers, I don't think they're top secret any longer, and handed them to me about the very first things of persistent homology. And his argument was the following, it's look, data is supposed to reflect relationships in the real world. And when we do machine learning, we're looking for relationships in the data that reflect the relationships in the real world. But when we just collect data, the very act of creating data, of sensing things, digitizing it, putting it in a computer, this distorts those relationships. And topological features are exactly the features of a system that are invariant under continuous distortions. So topological features of data are important, and these the classical versions of these methods are used all the time. They're very common, but they're not used as much as they might be because we'll see in just a second that they are computationally extremely intensive. And I think I want to emphasize for the quantum version of this, this is the one quantum algorithm we have for machine learning, the only one I'm aware of that is exponentially faster than the classical algorithms and does not require quantum random access memory. So no QRAM. QRAM not required for this, okay? And this algorithm I'm going to show you is exponentially faster than the best classical algorithms, and it seems highly implausible, for reasons you'll see in just a second, that you could ever construct a classical algorithm that will do what this quantum algorithm is going to do. Okay? I want to emphasize this here for you QRAM haters in the audience here. What's not to love about QRAM? I understand that quantum RAM, it's actually, anybody who wants to talk about how to make QRAM, let's talk about it later today. How do these algorithms work? Okay, what one is doing here when one triangulates the data is one is constructing simplices. So a simplex, if I have a point is what's called a zero simplex. A edge is a one simplex. A triangle is a two simplex. A tetrahedron is a three simplex, etc. And in triangulating the data in this fashion, one is creating a simplicial complex. A k-simplex has k plus 1 points, okay? And the way that algebraic topology is going to work is that each simplex in the complex is going to be mapped to a vector in a high-dimensional vector space. Well, now you get the initial sense of why this is going to be good to do quantum mechanically. So I'm going to map a k-simplex as follows. I'm going to just put ones. I'm going to have, if there are n points in the data, n points in the overall data set, I'm just going to put ones where there are vertices. So these are the first point, second point, third point, fourth point, fifth point, sixth point. So this is a simplex that has the vertices 2, 5, 7, and 8. Okay? It's a three simplex. Is this clear? This is the central how algebraic topology works. You map simplices to vectors in high-dimensional vector spaces. And you see right away that there are 2 to the n possible simplices. And you also see that as I increase this grouping scale, epsilon is this grouping scale, eventually all possible simplices will enter into the complex. Right? So for every scale epsilon, I have a simplicial complex. This is the simplicial complex at scale epsilon. As I vary epsilon, I go from having only the zero simplices in the complex, then some one simplices will show up, then some two simplices, triangles will show up. Eventually, when epsilon gets big enough, every single darn simplex in the complex is there. Okay? And so this is immediately says that there is a combinatorial explosion. Yeah.
Do you mean that really every simplex is realized? I don't think so, right?
Because if you start eventually for large enough epsilon, right? When epsilon is this, then everything is connected to everything else.
That's true, but if one look at the simplexes, for example, all the lines, one simplex, then you don't have connection far away, right? Because otherwise you should include everything in between.
If I connect everything that's within, if I say there's a line, with mm-hmm. things that are within epsilon. This is called the Vitoris-Rips complex, by the way. Then that means that here, this is connected to that over there, when okay. epsilon's that big. Of course, when epsilon's small, then it's not connected to it.
Okay, so you don't have to include all the points inside kind of the ball. You can select some inside and
no, all points, the idea, I set a scale epsilon, I connect any two points that are within epsilon of each other.
Okay.
That's how it works. When epsilon is big enough, everything's connected to everything else. When epsilon is zero, nothing's connected to anything else. And in between, you get a very complicated sequence mm-hmm. called a filtration. This is called a filtration. That will contain all possible simplices. Eventually, all possible simplices are contained in the complex. And the point is to look for persistence homology. The idea is to look at when topological features appear in this triangulated complex and when they go away. Mm-hmm. When epsilon is big enough, everything's gone away.
Okay.
Okay. Mm-hmm. All right. So I don't have that much time, but this is not that complicated. I mean, it's the whole point. I'm actually telling you the quantum mechanical version of it because I think the quantum mechanical version is easier to understand than the classical version. I was just writing the words combinatorial explosion. So just for the classical version, just to write out the whole filtration is exponential in the size of the simplicial of the data set. So the reason that the quantum version is exponentially faster is that we have states like this. We've mapped, we have a 2 to the n dimensional vector space with n qubits. And now we're going to do linear operations on that, find eigenvectors and eigenvalues of suitable maps. And that's going to give us the information that we need. This is why you don't need a QRAM for this. The difficulty of the classical analysis doesn't come because you have a gigantic data set. It's because you have a combinatorial explosion in the number of potential topological features. OK. So how does this work? So step one, we construct the simplicial state. I'll call it psi, maybe I'll call it sigma, capital sigma, epsilon, which is equal to the sum of all simplices that belong to the complex at scale epsilon of sigma. And there's 1 over whatever the square root of the number of this is. This you do using Grover. So you basically, this won't find many things if they were very, very sparse, but in the middle of this filtration where an epsilon gets big, basically there are a lot of simplices in the complex and you just construct all the simplices, a super quantum superposition of all the simplices in the complex. Now, here's the real kicker. You define something called the boundary map. This is how, this is kind of very basic. For people who haven't seen algebraic topology before, that's a very basic feature of algebraic topology. If I take a simplet sigma, so it's a K-simplex, and I write it as a list of vertices. So this is just a labels of the vertices, right? This is a different way of describing it than this particular method. I can either describe it like this by putting ones where the vertices are, or I can describe it like this. Then the boundary map, dk, acting on sigma k, is the following. It's equal to the sum, L is equal to 0 to up to k. And what I do is I look at the simplices that are on the boundaries. I omit the lth vertex, right? The boundary of a three simplex is these three two simplexes. Sorry, of two simplexes, these three one simplices. I get the things on the boundary by omitting this vertex, by omitting that vertex, and by omitting that vertex. But it's an oriented sum, so I have a minus one to the L. And now these are quantum states. So the boundary map acting on this right here, so D2 acting on this is basically equal to this minus this plus this. Remember, these are vectors when I say I'm omitting putting Dirac brackets around here. These are just vectors in this vector space. So it's a map. It's a map from the vector space of k simplices to the vector space of k minus 1 simplices. And it has the following features. Dk minus 1 dk is equal to 0. This is the boundary of a boundary is 0. And the reason it's called the boundary map is it actually does a really neat thing. If I have two simplices that are together like this, right, and I take, remember this is a vector, okay, and I take D2, the two-dimensional boundary map acting on this, this is equal to this plus this, sorry, this minus this plus this minus this plus this. This is the key thing. And then minus this, all interior lines get evaluated twice in opposite directions and they go away. This is the kind of the beauty of this algebraic topology. So in the end, these guys go away and you're just left with the things on the boundary. It's pretty cool. So a topological feature so e.g. a hole or void. So if I think of a hole, okay, so here's a hole that's in this right here. This hole right here, this is got right here, it is boundary, it doesn't have a boundary. So these things right here, if I add up something like this, I go around like here, I look at the boundary of something like this, there's no boundary. Because this point gets added once with a positive sign, once with a negative sign, this gets added once with a positive sign, once with a negative sign, this gets once with a positive sign, once with a negative sign, so D1 of this is equal to zero. So holes and voids don't have boundaries. So it's boundaryless. But the neat feature of something that's a hole is that it's also not the boundary of something else. Right, so here we have something, these points right here, they don't have a boundary going around like that. This gets added twice with opposite signs, this gets added twice with opposite signs, this gets added twice with opposite signs, this gets added twice with opposite signs. So this is not have a boundary, but it is the boundary of these two simplices put together. So it's not a hole, as you can see. It's filled in. They're boundaryless, but not boundaries. So they don't have a boundary in the set of k minus 1 simplices, but they're not the boundary of some set of k plus 1 simplices. So this is the defining feature of these topological features of holes and voids. They're surfaces that are boundaryless, but are not themselves the boundary of something that's in the complex. Yep, it will only take me a few minutes to do this, so. Let me just say what happens here. So we're looking for states such that dk of psi, this is a set of k simplices, is equal to zero, boundaryless. But psi k does not equal to the boundary of some k plus one chain of simplices in the complex. That is to say, it doesn't belong, it is not in the, it's orthogonal to the image of dk plus 1. So that's what we want to do. We want to find things that are like this. They are annihilated by, they're in the kernel of the boundary map. But they're not in the image of the boundary map applied at the next higher level. These are exactly the sets of holes, voids, high-dimensional voids, etc. And now we see we're in pretty good shape, because this is a linear map. The boundary map is linear. I just erased it, but it's sparse. It's the kind of thing we can exponentiate. And it turns out that the things that we're looking for, the set of all holes and voids, belong to the kernel of the following matrix. So big, ginormous 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix. Zeros along the diagonal. I won't, because I don't have time, I won't write this out, but by using the fact that the boundary of a boundary is zero, you can see that these things are exactly the stuff that we're interested in. It's actually the things that belong in the following. They belong in the kernel of what's called the combinatorial Laplacian, which is, let me see if I can get this right, dk plus dk plus 1, dk plus 1 dagger. If it's in the kernel of this positive operator, you see these are positive operators, then it's boundaryless. And if it's in the kernel of this positive operator, it's not a boundary. And the only way it can be in the kernel of the sum of two positive operators is if you're in the intersection of those two kernels. And so the things that are in this kernel are exactly the things that are boundaryless, but not boundaries. And now we simply apply the quantum phase algorithm. I'll call this matrix D. It's called the Dirac matrix, actually, ironically. It's the Dirac matrix because if you square it, this is called the Laplacian, the combinatorial Laplacian. And if you square this, you basically get the matrix with these things on the diagonal. So the Dirac matrix is the square root of the Laplacian. That's why it's called the Dirac matrix by people in algebraic topology. So now it's pretty simple. We just apply the quantum phase algorithm. To D, we identify if the eigenvalue equals zero, that means success. And this means that we can find plus count the number of the holes, voids, dot, 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 at scale epsilon. And it is in time, basically order, I think it goes as log n, sorry, we're using n here to mean the total number of points, so it goes as something like n cubed, n squared, I guess, n squared over epsilon, where epsilon is the accuracy to which you evaluate the kernel, the zero eigenvalue. And the classical versions of this, the classical version of this, you actually have to diagonalize this gigantic matrix. So that would take time, order n cubed for Gaussian elimination. Sneaker methods, because it's sparse, will take you to order 2 to the 3n, or order 2 to the 2n for sneakier versions for sparse matrices. Okay. So let me just summarize. I'm over time. My fault for actually summarizing things at the beginning. And I'm sorry I kind of rushed through this a little bit, but I gave this sketch here. I think this sketch should tell you what's going on. So what's going on? Persistent homology is a very popular way of analyzing data, classical data, to find topological features. Topological features are very important features of data because they are exactly the features that are invariant under continuous distortion. And so if you can find topological features, you think, okay, if it has a hole, it has a hole. The classical versions suffer Because if they want to find high-dimensional holes and voids in the data, then there's this exponential explosion, combinatorial explosion, that just makes the whole problem a big, huge mess and exponentially bad. The classical algorithms work by algebraic topology, and algebraic topology is a method of taking something that looks, you know, topology doesn't look like it has anything to do with matrices and vectors, but it says, oh, well, let's like take this simplicial complex and map each simplex into a vector in a very high-dimensional vector space, and then you can start answering questions about topology by looking at linear operators on this extremely high-dimensional vector space. A 2 to the n dimensional vector space. So looking at this Dirac operator, the kernel of this Dirac operator identifies the topological features. Now, this wouldn't help you very much classically, because it's a 2 to the n by 2 to the n matrix, which is what gives rise to these terrible scalings. But quantum mechanically, you're good to go, because we just do the mapping of our 2 to the n dimensional vector space becomes n qubits. The Dirac operator is a sparse operator on this high-dimensional vector space. We can apply the quantum phase algorithm, and then we can identify the kernel of this operator. The kernel of this operator is exactly the set of topological features. In the process of identifying the kernel, we actually get to estimate the number of topological features. This is what's called the Betti numbers of this complex. And so we have a quantum algorithm that's exponentially better than the classical algorithms for doing this full persistent homology. It takes time order n squared instead of time 2 to the 2n, which I think you'll agree is a speed up. And it doesn't require quantum random access memory. So it's the only example that I know of a quantum algorithm, machine learning algorithm, that gives that doesn't require quantum random access memory, that gives an exponential speed up over the best classical algorithms. And with that, I would like to thank the organizers again for tossing a great conference. Sorry for going over. Thank you very much. Yes.
Maybe it just slipped my attention, but like, could you give us again the connection to machine learning? So like problem of prediction from data. I know like data analysis, like I can find structures in data and that might be interesting for various reasons, but is there anything like in industrial applications where you could actually propose this algorithm now?
Well, I mean, finding topological features of data is an exercise in machine learning to find topological features of data. You want to learn the topological features of the data. So that's its connection to machine learning. I think, however, you must have meant something more. Like, so what is maybe what you're saying, right? So what's important about topological features of data? Well, actually, so what people use this for classically, the low-dimensional versions, which are more efficient classically, where you'd like have a two-dimensional surface, they actually use this a lot in animation, okay? Because you know the topology if you have a two-dimensional surface that bounds a three-dimensional object that has complicated things like holes and stuff like that, then actually it's important to be able to figure out what these topological features are. So that's a place where it gets used. These very high-dimensional features, like when k gets big, you know, data sets, you know, if you have even if you just have a one-dimensional data set, if you have a notion of a metric, you can embed it in a very high-dimensional vector space. That's actually the way that you normally represent a string of bits, for instance. You embed it in a very high-dimensional vector space. And then the topological features of this data are like a fingerprint for this data. So if you look at these topological features as a function of epsilon, this is called the barcode, by the way, because as epsilon increases, you say, oh, look, here this hole came into existence, it persisted for this time, epsilon, then it went away again. And so you basically draw this out as a whole bunch of bars. Each topological feature gets a bar. As epsilon increases, it comes into existence, and then it goes away again. And so you get a barcode. This barcode is like a topological fingerprint for the data. So if two data sets have the same topology, then they're related in some way. The high-dimensional versions of this it's a really interesting question. It's hard to visualize these high-dimensional holes and voids, at least for me. And because it's so difficult to compute them, it basically goes exponentially in k, where k is the number of simplices. Because it's so difficult to compute them, people don't compute them. But so it would be very interesting to find out other uses for these high dimensional topological signatures. But as a signature of data, it's a very good signature of data. And that's what people tell me, that this is one of the main uses of this. It's like, if two data sets have the same topology, then one is in some sense just a distorted version of the other one.
So is this approach robust? Does this approach work when you don't know K? You've mentioned a couple times, for instance, about higher dimensional embeddings being given by a metric. So if you have a kernel, take RBF, whatever your favorite kernel, then you might not necessarily know K, or it could even be continuous. So
yeah, this finds it for all K, right? The things you're looking for, the things that are boundaryless but don't have boundaries at level k, are the kernel of this operator acting on the subspace corresponding to k simplices. So when you get what you get when you actually diagonalize, when you apply the quantum phase algorithm, is that you in fact get the zero eigenvalues for all values of k. So you don't have to pick k to begin with. You could, of course, if you want, you could just pick this particular value of k equals 75, which is impossible classically, because 2 to the 150 is a large number, right? Which is perfectly fine quantum mechanically. So you could pick k equals 75 and look at 75 dimensional voids and holes. But actually, the algorithm itself is agnostic as to what k is. This operator acts on all, on zero simplices, one simplices, two simplices, three simplices, up to n simplices. There are n choose k plus one k simplices. It's this combinatorial explosion that makes the high dimensional things hard to get. But the algorithm reveals all of them. So you don't have to be picky.
So regarding the notion of persistent homology, if I'm given n data points, does it make sense to talk about these topological invariants in dimensions parametrically larger than log n?
Yeah, sure. Why not?
It seems to me that in very large dimensions, ultimately everything will be within an epsilon ball, and it doesn't make sense to talk about different scales and things clustered on one scale and not on another.
You're saying that as... I'm not sure what you're saying.
For an example, let's say we have n data points and embed them in a space of dimension, say, n over 2.
Okay.
Will I still see this notion of some hole and some things clustering together? Or do I need to reduce the dimension significantly to be able to observe such things?
No, you won't, n over 2, right? See, in order to see these high dimensional topological features, you need a vector space that's exponentially larger than the number of points. That's the whole problem. So I mean, the reason that I can take something that's topological, which seems to have nothing to do with linear algebra, and solve it using linear algebra, is that this embedding is in a very high dimensional vector space, so that I can actually encode the features there. This is not the kind of embedding that you'd want to do if you were trying to give some very low dimensional picture of the data, right? I mean, it's a very specific type of embedding and an extremely high dimensional embedding. I think probably if you try to embed it in too small a space, you won't be able to see these higher dimensional features. I think that's likely. Though I don't know how one would go about doing it in the smaller dimensional space. But it does work in this high dimensional space. Algebraic topology, this discrete algebraic topology, this is what I've described here is actually called discrete Hodge theory. This has been around since the 1930s. It started being applied to these data sets in the 1990s. But it's a pretty well-established branch of mathematics. May I actually say that as just an advertisement, that not only do we find the kernel of this operator, but we actually find all the eigenvectors and eigenvalues of it. We're sampling from the eigenvectors and eigenvalues. And that gives us, Hodge theory relates the geometry of these, which is this basically the higher dimensional eigenvector, the non-zero eigenvalues of this are related to the geometry. There's the non-topologically invariant features of this. And so we're actually revealing features of the geometry as well, though God knows what they actually mean. Actually, the gap of this Hamiltonian, this is the gap of this Hamiltonian, if you think of this as a Hamiltonian, its energy gap, if I have, it represents, this is a Hamiltonian that gives diffusion of simplices throughout this complex. If you have, the simplices are kind of taking random walks around the complex. And the gap gives you the rate at which this diffusion process converges. That's the one thing I know, which we also get that information as well, above and beyond the topological information. But I don't know what these other, this question of what these eigenvectors and eigenvalues mean, this is, there's a famous paper by Mark Kotz called can you hear the shape, can you hear the shape of a drum, right? The shape of a drum head is a geometrical question, and suppose you dot it with simplices, the question is, can you figure out what the geometry is just from listening to the sound? And that's kind of what these higher level non-zero eigenvalues are about. Yeah.
Are you able to access any information on the cohomology of these kinds of data structures? And because it has a richer algebraic structure.
Yeah, that would be that's certainly on our to-do list, and you're welcome to join us, right? I mean, we did the homology because we could, right? And it's already something that's exponentially faster, but it would be great to do the cohomology. I think that you know what this basically this result says is that because of these, we just took existing mathematical facts about relationship between homology and Hodge theory, and we quantized it. It turned out to be easy to quantize because it's again one of these things that when there's this underlying linear structure, you can do this. We are kind of stuck on the cohomology, so if you want to talk with us and maybe we can figure it out, that would be great. So I would love to have a quantum algorithm for doing cohomology as well as just homology. It would be great. Other people have suggested, and we've been working on this too without success, is knot theory. Can we do a quantum algorithm for knot theory as well using algebraic topology? And the answer is, beats me. We've tried and failed, but that doesn't mean it can't be done.
Let's end it there and thank Seth again.
Thank you.